FAE.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We tend to think of the gathering of data to be a relatively new activity by our government, but they've actually been doing it for a long time. And one of the key locations for the collection of data on the East Coast turns out to have been the North Carolina Mountains in a former NASA facility that is now being repurposed yet again. We find out more about that later in the program. First, though, a kind of victory march. While many arts groups struggle to find funding and build or maintain audiences, in Charlotte, Opera Carolina is finding new ways to operate successfully in a challenging environment. One way is through collaboration with other companies, so it feels only appropriate to celebrate that by playing one of opera's most famous pieces, the Triumphal March from Giuseppe Verdi's Aida. Opera Carolina has opened their 65th season with Aida, one of Verdi's most popular works and one which has already received favorable reviews here. So let's spend some time talking about all this today with James Mina, Opera Carolina's general director and principal conductor. Always nice to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
And he's brought along two of the leads in this production. Othala Graham is, and I hope I said that correctly, is a Canadian, I'll let you fix it, Canadian-American soprano who plays the title role, and Mark Rucker is an American baritone singing the role of Aida's father. Welcome to both of you, and correct me now.
Awfully.
That's awfully hard for me to say.
Yes, it is for everyone.
Aida is one of Verdi's most popular operas, and Verdi is a composer that you seem to go back to a lot. Il Trovatore, La Traviata, Otello you did a couple of years ago. What is it about Opera Carolina and Verdi, or opera and Verdi, that makes him so...
He sells a lot of tickets.
he says with a glint in his eye.
No, Mike, it's part of it is practical. You know, Verdi's operas are the core of the standard operatic repertory.
Because
they sell tickets, because people love these operas, because the complete fusion of the great music with these poignant stories, the very human stories, speak to us so well today. Mm-hmm. We kind of get it. You know, Aida is this love story of two women vying for the affections of the general of Egypt, you know, and there are overtones of slavery, there are overtones of oppression, and it's just, you know, it's a story that we understand today. It's a very simple story, and yet when you marry that story with the great music of Verdi, these wonderful melodies that you just walk out of the auditorium humming, it's a hit.
Let me blaspheme for a moment. Many people will know Aida from the Elton John musical.
Mm-hmm.
Are there parallels? Obviously, the story is highly
similar. It's the same story.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the same story. And I forgive me for saying this. I haven't done any research on the Elton John. I think it's Elton John, Tim Rice, Aida. But, it's the same story, which tells you a great deal about the story itself. It is contemporary as well as, you know, being classic.
And you've performed this role that you're performing, Mark, in Aida around the world. You're about to do it again after this closes, I think, in Europe. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Is Verdi the same reception everywhere? Does it get the same reception everywhere?
I have never been anywhere that it didn't. As Maestro has said, it is, when you think of opera, you think of Verdi. You can say Puccini and the other composers, but Verdi had a humanistic approach to writing,
mm-hmm.
and he loved family. So a lot of what you get, especially like in this piece and in other pieces that he's done, like Rigoletto and things, where you get this father-child relationship. And so that speaks to a lot of people. I see when people come see Rigoletto, I say, okay, bring your husbands. bring the fathers, because mm-hmm. they will appreciate the fact that Rigoletto wants to save his daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they appreciate the fact that he might want to save her, but it, you know, the stupid things that he does winds up being problematic. But Verdi is the most understanding, I think, of all of the composers.
Music is kind of mysterious because there's no predicting necessarily what's going to be popular and what will strike a chord in people. But the two of you, Mark and
Offaly.
I'm going to get this. It kills me. I want to get to the genesis of that name in a second. The two of you study music and that's your life. I mean, you learn new pieces of music, you learn scores. When you look at a piece, when you look at an opera, when you look at an aria that you're going to have to perform, and can you tell what it is about that piece that's going to tug at somebody's heartstrings?
I think you can. I mean, I think it sort of depends on, with Aida especially, I find that there are so many moments that women, especially between the relationships with the jealousy between two women, the relationship with her father, which is very important. And in our production really focuses a lot on that. Mm-hmm. And our production, because we don't have, you know, the sometimes I think unnecessary pomp and circumstance, we focus solely on the relationships between each character. Mm-hmm. And because we don't have the pomp and circumstance, we allow ourselves to really pay attention to smaller details that a lot of people who do this opera miss.
People who don't know, because we've gotten so used to the glitz and the fireworks and mm-hmm. the pyrotechnics of modern performance, sometimes that obscures the real story. And when you take away all of that, suddenly the story is revealed
right.
in a way that people find really impactful.
And that's exactly what we've done with this production, Mike. We've yes, there's spectacle. It's a big, huge, gorgeous production of Aida with, you know, all the dancers and the extras and all of that. No animals. But we decided to focus on the theater, on the theatrical aspects of this story. So you'll find that it's as intimate an opera as any mm-hmm. opera, set against this grand spectacle of the Sphinx and the pyramids and Pharaoh and all of that sort of stuff. But essentially, we've taken it, drilled down to this fundamental relationship between these four characters, you know, the two women, the father, and the love interest.
Now, you mentioned these animals that are sometimes part of these productions of Aida, and it's known for having elephants. And I suppose if you eliminate the elephant, it becomes safer to walk on the stage.
It's very much so.
Especially for the
Ethiopians.
For a lot
of reasons.
Exactly.
You don't have to watch where you put your feet necessarily. But I'm told that you have added something that other productions do not have, and that is twerking. I read a review of this.
Oh, I missed that.
I read a review. You have choreography by a fellow out of New York mm-hmm. whose name is going to escape me now.
Eric
Schoenfogel, who has done some amazing choreography for this, which includes twerking. Do you know what that is, Jim?
I must confess I have no idea what twerking is.
Then I'm not going to tell you. This is the opening of the
Is anyone surprised I don't know what twerking
no
is?
No one is surprised that you don't know.
This is the opening show of the 65th season of Opera Carolina. I'd like you to put that number into perspective. How many cities of this size have companies that have been in existence since 1948?
Very few. Not Atlanta, not Detroit, not Cleveland Opera is gone. Our colleagues with companies as old or older would be New Orleans, mm-hmm. Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and, of course, New York. And that, I think, is in San Francisco and Chicago. Mm. But I think that's about it. Even L.A. Opera is only 25 years or so.
And I read an interview with you that said opera companies are shuttering around the country, around the world.
Well, unfortunately, yes. It is a bad economic time anyway, but we're having more and more problems that way. And the arts, unfortunately, are an easy target. for politics and for everything else.
So this is an oasis, and I guess, and we'll talk about this, why you did this production the way you did it, and the fact that it's a cooperative production between Toledo Opera and Opera Carolina. There's a reason for that, and that is economics, which we'll talk about.
Awfully.
Awfully. I'm so sorry. Where did that name come from?
It was
my mom and dad.
Yes, my great parents. It was my father's mother's name, and she died shortly after giving birth to him, and he was determined that his daughter would be named after his mother. And as a child, of course, to have such an unusual name, it certainly was not my favorite, but it's served me well now because there's just me.
Well, also, we have to practice saying it, so we get to know you just by practicing. You've said that this is the perfect opera for both first-time opera goers and long-standing lovers of the art form, because it has it all. What does that mean?
It really does. I mean, it has such – of course, Verdi has some of the greatest music in the world. Long-time opera goers who have seen the opera many times will see things that they have not seen again, because we've, you know, taken away some of the things that I think are completely unnecessary. I don't think an elephant adds anything to the show other than mess on the stage. So it really has forced us as singing actors and actresses to really delve into our characters a lot more, and it really helps to showcase the music and our acting abilities.
We've talked about this a little in the past with opera singers, because you seem to live out of a suitcase and travel the world, and opera singers build a repertoire of roles that they are repeatedly called on to play. You're relatively new to the role.
I am definitely new to this one.
But when did you start working on this?
Well, I did it in Turkey in the arena to do their first summer festival, which was a completely different experience for me. But I had worked on it vocally periodically, you know, throughout the years. I had done it once prior to that. But I get called on for other repertoire. But when this opportunity arose to do it with Maestro Mina, I mean, you know, you certainly don't turn down that chance ever. And I've learned more vocally, physically, emotionally, and as an actress during this production than I have so far in my career.
How so?
Aida for me is very exposed, and it calls on any singer. There are no hiding places, as there are, let's say, in Turandot or some Wagner. So with all of the places that are exposed, it requires a certain technical finesse that isn't in a lot of other repertoire. So.
Give me an example of a hiding place, and since there are none in this for you, what does that mean?
Oh, a place where, you know, the orchestra, a place where you're not hidden, an exposed part, let's say in O Patria Mia, you know, there's a beautiful ending with a lot of floating and soft singing that I don't get called on a lot for in Turandot and let's say Isolde. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a scary moment for a lot of sopranos, but certainly one that I now love to do.
Well, part of it, Anthony, is you alluded to this in Wagner particularly, you always have that big cushion of the orchestra, always. And the orchestra in Wagner is very much, sometimes it can compete, but when it's done correctly, it is like having this grand cushion of sound under you. And so you don't feel like you're quite so exposed all the time. I mean, Verdi, because he's such a humanist when he writes, he wants to have the artist exposed on stage, because that's what's compelling to him.
It's about the voice.
Yeah. The voice.
Athalie Graham, Mark Rucker, James Mina with us. We're talking about Opera Carolina's current production, Aida, which continues tomorrow and Saturday at the Belk. We will continue in just a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Christmas Made in the South, a fine arts and crafts festival featuring the works of over 300 artists and master craftsmen. Cabarrus Serena, October 25th through 27th, madeinthesouthshows.com. And UNC Charlotte's Barnhart Seminar, former Lance CEO David V. Singer presents Confronting Fraud in the Workplace, Thursday, 6:30 at Center City. For reservations, 704-687-0084. Perhaps you've noticed the world has gone pink this month. It's everywhere on ribbons. They've colored the water in fountains pink. Even the newspaper printed an edition on pink paper. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and that accounts for all the pink. But can all this pink really be helping? Is it raising awareness? Is it helping to raise funds? Does it have an impact? We talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in new reports, human rights groups allege U.S. drone strikes killed civilians in Pakistan and Yemen in violation of international law. New questions about the U.S. drone program and its legality.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here talking about Opera Carolina's production of Aida, which opened its 65th anniversary season earlier in the week, and they perform not Saturday, but tomorrow and Sunday. Tomorrow and Sunday at the Belk, operacarolina.org, or 704-372-1000. Offaly Graham is with us. She plays Aida. Mark Rucker is Aida's father. James Mina is the general director and principal conductor of Opera Carolina. The three of you came together for this production several months ago to do it first in Toledo. I know that you've bicycled sets and costumes from production to production in the past. Is this the first time that an entire production has started in one place and moved here, or started here and moved to another place?
No, Mike. This is an old idea that actually the very first production of this kind that I was involved with was 1979 between Connecticut Opera, Pittsburgh Opera, and Cincinnati Opera. And it was a production of Carmen with Samuel Raimi and Victoria Vergara. And it originated in Connecticut, came to Pittsburgh, and then went to Cincinnati. And I thought, gee, this is really a good idea. Same cast, same set, same costumes. And in each local city, we added the orchestra and the chorus and the extras. And for a number of years, most people don't know this, but a number of years, when I first came to North Carolina, the company in Winston-Salem was ready to go bankrupt. And so I think it was maybe four or five seasons. We actually co-produced, we actually produced the seasons in Winston-Salem. We never called it Opera Carolina. We always called it Piedmont Opera. But they were productions from Charlotte. And then we would take them to Winston, or the other way around. We would originate a production and bring it here. And so similar situation. 2 years ago, Toledo Opera was ready to go bankrupt. And I called some friends in Ohio that I know. I said, look, let's fix this. And so we have a partnership now with that company where, in this case, we originated Aida in Ohio and then brought it here. Next season, we'll originate our production of Lucia di Lammermoor here in Charlotte, and then it'll go to Toledo.
This makes so much sense on so many levels. And I would think artistically, from your points of view as performers and as singers, that this makes sense because normally when you play Aida's father, which you are doing now, and then you will move it to you just told me where you're going and I've forgotten.
Belgium.
Belgium. You're working with a whole new group of people. Mm-hmm. And obviously that does change your performance, and you have to get used to new blocking and all that kind of stuff. This way you can really refine what you're doing within the confines of this production by doing it in two different places with the same people over and over again. Am I on the right track?
Sure, absolutely. The other part of it, of course, is that there are more performances.
Yes.
I mean, there just literally are more performances to do.
And you make more money.
And you make more money.
Let me write this down.
Have to pour that in. But I mean, you know, it's sometimes in like if you're in Europe where they do quite a few performances of something, you're there for a long time and you keep doing it. But it gets somewhat frustrating at times when you go to a company and you work so hard on a production, and then you get to the performances, and the next thing you know, it's over.
It's over, yeah.
You know, I told somebody the other day, we were talking about, you know, having the end of Aida happen, and one of the most depressing things for me is when you get to the final chord of the last performance, because you know that's it, you know. And I'm always hyped about doing, even a character I've done quite a bit, about doing it with other people. Because they bring to it something else that you have to react differently to.
Because that's what acting is.
Indeed. Reacting is the whole thing. So,
opera singers do have a repertoire of roles that they become known for, and they're called on to play them again and again and again, which I think has its own special magic because you get to really get that into your bones, those roles. But what's it like to come to something relatively new to it, as you have in this case? Because here you are with a guy who has played this role repeatedly in mm-hmm. his career and will do it again. And you're relatively new in the role of Aida, but you're on stage with people who have done it and done it and done it. Does that put particular pressure on you?
I think the entire cast is actually full of people who've done, you know, hundreds of Aidas. And I think, yes, in the beginning, you know, through the summer, I was sort of, oh, you know, this cast of seasoned veterans in this role. But I have to say that this has been, for me, the greatest experience, of course, because I'm working with Maestro Mina, but also with my other cast members, because everyone is so incredibly supportive and loving. And because, you know, there's certainly no competition amongst us. Everyone wants me, especially because I'm newer, mm-hmm. to do incredibly well. So it's wonderful when I'm singing O Patria Mia, the thing that we said that was so exposed, to have my cast members, you know, come up from their dressing rooms and be in the wings listening to be supportive. It's wonderful. It's such a great feeling. And I have to say that, as Mark said, at the final chord, there'll be a lot of tears for me and the rest of us.
There are so few people in the world and in the world of arts who have the voices that opera singers have, who have the instrument and the talent to pull it off and the experience and training to pull it off. I'm just always curious, because there's so few of you in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. What is it that got you into this in the first place? I'll start with you, Othello.
For me, it was seeing a live – my father got tickets for us to see Leontine Price live. And seeing her was so exciting, but what really cemented it for me was hearing Birgit Nilsson sing Turandot on a video that I saw. Just, it was the most exciting thing I had ever seen, and
Eight. And most eight-year-olds will be listening to Katy Perry.
Yes, so right now, yeah, absolutely. But it was, you know, we always had opera playing in the house, sort of as background music, which is rare for most people, but hearing Turandot for me really started everything.
You have a Leontine Price story, don't you, Mark?
Several.
Yeah. My father was friends with Bill Warfield, and I had been accepted to do – well, somebody had asked me at a very young age to do a concert version of Porgy and Bess, and so I went to Bill's house to work with him on it, which I didn't know he was Bill Warfield at the time. And so I was singing through the piece, and he was singing everything else. And we got to Bess, Here's My Woman. I was kind of looking out the window, and I was singing, and he was singing. And the next thing you know, the transition comes, Porgy, and it didn't sound like him anymore. And I turned around, and it was her.
Oh, my God.
And I couldn't sing anymore after that. The next thing I heard her say was, "Boy, what's wrong with you?"
And you had seen her. Wasn't she the first person you saw at the Met?
Yes, I saw her in Aida at the Met.
In Aida?
Yeah.
It's full circle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
indeed.
It is.
She was fantastic, of course. And when she did it for her final, I wanted to actually strangle Simon Estes, who got to sing with her in the final production of Aida that she did, because I wanted to do
it. You wanted to do it. So you had regained your voice in front of her by then.
I would like to say one thing about Athalie. This may be her first real run at this thing, mm-hmm. but I defy anybody who comes to this production to tell me that it's her first. She comes with a huge amount of intelligence to this part that you just don't see normally for somebody trying this for the first time. So we are all honored to sing with her in this. So I just wanted to say that.
I appreciate that.
That's very nice. That's very nice. In your performance in Toledo, Mark, the critic said that you were able to reach over the footlights through superb acting and vocal magic. So let's hear a little bit of – I'm not sure which production this comes from, but this is you as Aida's father.
Thank you.
that was surreptitiously recorded by somebody in the audience. That explains the coughing and the noise on the iPhone.
what we used to call a pirate recording, but now they're all over the place.
They're everywhere. There's that voice, obviously, that puts it over the footlights. What we can't see, because this is radio, is the acting portion of this. What does it take to do that, to put it over the footlights?
When you find that, let me know. I don't know. I don't even know the answer to that question, other than I try my best to relate to the character, to try to understand the character. You know, you're doing parts that people think are the bad guy parts or the, you know, the exam things. I never go at it that way. I always kind of go at it that nobody actually thinks they're bad. Most people think they're justified.
That's right.
Well, again, I'll help you with this because, you know, over the last 20 years, opera singers have been have become more actors who sing as opposed to just singers who, you know, in the 50s, 40s, and before, it was just fine to stand up on stage and sing beautifully and be in costume, and the spectacle was enough. And most of the acting happened with the voice. Now, because we're so visually oriented, you have really wonderful actors on stage, and what happens, I know it happens with you because I watch it all the time when you're on stage, it's this marriage of your experience with the role and your deep emotional connection to this guy. It's, you know, it's clear that that's what's taking you across the footlights.
Well, I want to thank whoever it was who recorded that on their iPhone in the theater, but I also want to salute Othely, who is my personal heroine. Because evidently on dress rehearsal night at Opera Carolina's production of this, somebody was on their phone in the auditorium.
Oh, God.
And
how do you know that story?
I know stuff. and you didn't say anything. You didn't stop the show because that would not. But you did. You were shooting daggers. And then you wrote a blog post about it or a Twitter about it, a tweet about it.
I did.
Saying essentially that he was incredibly rude. People in theaters should know this because when you sit in a movie theater and somebody pulls out their phone to text, it lights up the theater. It's brighter than the screen. They think that you're up there. They think you're a movie. You're not. You can see them. It's like a spotlight.
It really is. And what I found, the reason I was so, I mean, I'm offended, period. But the reason I was even more offended was our dress rehearsals are open to students. And it's such an incredible experience. And for most of them, it's their first experience at the opera. And the person in question was a male teacher. And I was suitably offended. And while I was singing, I was pointing at him and, yes, shooting many daggers and was not impressed.
Well, good for you.
Yes, good for me. I just – I mean, it was a terrible example that he set for the students. And to be texting while I'm singing is certainly never appropriate.
Should have come off the stage.
Yes.
Supply staircases into the house. You told Lake Norman magazine that a typical day for you starts with 7 shots of espresso before you get out of bed.
Now, really?
Yes.
Is that true?
That is absolutely – that is so true that anyone who knows me knows that it's absolutely true. I've gone through – unfortunately, there is a Starbucks drive-thru very close to our – adjacent to our hotel. And at you know, it takes a long time to single brew 7 shots of espresso. It can take a while. So I have been known to brew them the night before and just warm them up in the morning, or to go through the drive-thru and ask for 7 or 8 shots of espresso and – and I know it's terrible. Yeah, I'm working on reducing that.
How are you managing to sit in that chair?
I know, exactly. To sit still.
She's pretty high on stage, actually.
You know, you guys travel. Opera singers have to travel because you can't make a living staying in one place and singing for one company. You have to travel. It seems as though you live out of suitcases. How do you stay in shape physically and vocally? Because that's the hardest part, it would seem to me. Strange beds, strange hotels, strange hours, not around your stuff, just a suitcase full of things, that's it.
Well, I will say one thing. I'm very lucky because I travel with an incredible woman who happens to be my wife.
I'm glad you said that.
And she – yeah, I have – you know, the money thing happens. And no, no, but she is the grounding part of this travel. You know, she takes care of things. Then I don't have to worry about those kinds of things. And she'll, you know, push me on stage when I don't feel like going and that kind of stuff. But I can't imagine my life on any stage anywhere in the world without her. So I have a life no matter where I travel.
Hmm.
I find for – I actually do – I usually travel with my mother. So for this production, I didn't. But I find a lot of us travel with someone at some point. And it certainly helps to keep us together. Most hotels have gyms. We all, you know, walk a lot together sometimes. This production is very physical, so you have to be in good shape mm-hmm. in order to do this, especially now. As Maestro said, there is no standing and singing anymore.
Opera is a European tradition, and I know that people can't tell this because this is radio, but you are an African-American and you are an African-Canadian-American.
I am.
And you're a rare breed in opera, and I know that it's important to you to attract African-Americans to sit in the seats and see that this is something that speaks to them and can be performed by them.
Oh, absolutely. We had a masterclass yesterday where we had several people from Help Me With the School.
Or Johnson C. Smith with
me. Right. And a lot of young people came and sang for us, and it was very encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
It's always encouraging for any young people to come and sing. Because
Mark, you guys probably didn't notice this, but 6 out of the 8 singers yesterday were of color.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right,
which is extremely gratifying and brings a great deal of optimism.
And you have the 40-member Johnson C. Smith choir on stage for
this
production.
Yes, they're joining the opera chorus, and which is fabulous because the kids were so well disciplined, so well prepared, and it's been an experience of a lifetime for many of them.
You are determined, I know, Jim, to keep opera healthy and alive. And one of the ways you need to do this, any arts group needs to do this, is to build new audiences, mm-hmm. people who have never come to a play or an opera or a symphony concert.
Right.
How have you been attracting new people into the seats?
There is no one set way that we do it, Mike. It's a whole series of initiatives that we started actually almost 10 years ago. This all began. At the opera, the bottom line is that our business model has changed where our primary focus is not producing product.
Mm-hmm.
It's about building audiences. And that's what everybody in board and staff, that's our first mission.
And as Offaly has said, this is a great place to start this opera, Aida, because you hardly even need the super titles mm-hmm. to understand right. what's going on. It's all transmitted in the acting and in the singing and in the music. Aida tomorrow and Sunday at the Belk Opera Carolina. Offaly Graham, Mark Rucker, James Mina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Catawba College in Salisbury, serving traditional and adult students since 1851, an education dedicated to personal attention, blending liberal arts with career preparation. Details at catawba.edu. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. In new reports, human rights groups allege U.S. drone strikes unlawfully killed civilians in Pakistan and Yemen in violation of international law. Diane and her guests will talk about the new questions about the legality of the U.S. drone program coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And we are coming right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks is celebrating 15 years on WFAE, and to mark the occasion, we are hosting a special evening with best-selling author of the Bones book series, Kathy Reichs. Join us November 6th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater and be part of our studio audience. And after our special show, stay for an anniversary dessert reception. Go to WFAE.org for ticket information and more details, or call 704-372-1000. Hope to see you there. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Thoughts of Cold War espionage usually involve dangerous and exotic locations, but think again. In the early 1960s, in a beautiful corner of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the government created a facility to help with its fledgling space program. That site soon became the East Coast's most important satellite tracking and data acquisition facility. Perry, the Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute, played an important role in some of our most vital agencies, from NASA to the Department of Defense, and is now transitioning yet again as Perry becomes an educational facility for teaching STEM and other programs. We're going to take a look back at the site's storied history with Dr. David Clavier, who is Vice President of Administration and Development for the Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And also in our studio, Kent Steiner, a volunteer there and a member of the Charlotte Astronomers Club. He's involved in a project to refurbish, I think, two 12-meter radio telescopes at Perry, which have been kind of in mothballs for about two decades. Thank you for being here as well.
Good morning, Mike.
The Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute, I knew nothing about this. I'd never heard of this before. It started life 50 years ago as the Rosman Tracking Station. And what was it originally designed to do?
Well, that's exactly right, Mike. It was, in fact, this Saturday we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the original dedication, where Senator Sam Ervin and Terry Sanford and dignitaries from NASA came down to dedicate the site. It's in the middle of the National Forest, Pisgah National Forest, southwest of Asheville. I live in Brevard, mm-hmm. so it's about 2.5 hours from here. It's not a bad drive. My wife likes to come over to the South Park Mall, so it's a nice drive over. And it is a very unique and important facility for the United States, really. Yeah. But it started in 63 basically as the communication and tracking station for the early NASA programs, speaking with the astronauts as they circled the Earth and went to the moon. There were, I think, 22 of these stations that were built around the world. It was prior to satellites. So all the satellite development on the East Coast was done there, right there outside of Rosman.
So once the Gemini and the Apollo and the Mercury capsules were launched from Cape Canaveral,
right.
Communication from this part of the world went through that location in the mountains. Why not just keep it at Cape Canaveral?
Well, the early phase. Well, essentially, when you think about back in the 60s, what happened is we didn't have the satellites for the communication.
Right.
So you had to have direct line of sight. So you had these sites were built around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Australia, there was one on a ship. They're really all over the world. After satellites were launched and communication was able, we were able to communicate using the satellites, they became redundant, and so that's when this site was turned over to the Department of Defense.
And it was located in the mountains of North Carolina for a reason. What was the reason for that?
Essentially, it's because it's a very quiet site. It's down in a bowl. It's in an old mica mine. Was the basis of it. It was in the middle of National Forest. There was not a lot of interference, radio interference. It also makes for a wonderful site because it's very dark. So we've converted over and we do a lot of optical astronomy
mm-hmm.
now. And I'm going to keep referring to Perry because if I say Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute
show will
every
be
time,
over.
Yeah, portion will be over. So we'll call it Perry. Everybody knows it as that.
But why was it important that it be that there not be a lot of light pollution at the time NASA ran it?
Well, at the time, for light pollution wasn't really an issue.
Okay.
It was really the radio frequency interference, and that was particularly
why
important.
Why isn't there because broadcast signals go through the mountains? I mean, why was there limited interference? From
it
radio?
Sits down in a valley, in a bowl. It's really quite interesting. We've got a ridge that goes all the way around the site.
So, for people who are not aware of this, where precisely you can now tell us because at one point it was secret. Where precisely? Is this
okay? If you're familiar at all with Western Carolina, if you're heading toward Cashers or you're heading toward Lake Toxaway in that area, you'll take 64 and you'll turn right on 215, head right on up into the National Forest, go about 6 miles, and we're right up there in the middle of the National Forest. So I live in Brevard. It's about 25 minutes from my home in Brevard. So it's west of Brevard and east of Cashers and southwest of Asheville, and it's a beautiful location.
We'll talk about this, the fact that you want people to come. There was a long period of this location's history where not only did they not want you to come, they didn't want you to know that it existed, and if you got too close to it, armed guards would confront you. This is when it transitioned from NASA to the Department of Defense.
That's true.
That was really just a cover. It was not really the Department of Defense. It was the National Security Agency, the NSA, who took this over. For what purpose? How are they using this facility?
I like you.
You're not allowed to tell us.
I like you can go on the internet and try to read and try to figure out what was going on. But honestly, it was turned over to the Department of Defense, and whoever was there, whatever agencies were there, whatever organizations were there. One of the interesting things this Saturday that you might find out is that we're going on the dedication, we're going to have basically people, three panels. We're going to have three forum panels. One is going to talk about NASA, and we've got some people that are going to talk about talking to the astronauts and having the astronauts talking to Kennedy and Johnson directly. That came through Rosman and was communicated there. We're going to have a panel that's going to be made up of people from the Department of Defense, and the organizations were there at that time. And I'm not sure what they'll say because I don't know, and we'll find out. And then we'll have a panel that'll talk about what we've done at Perry for the last since 1999.
Now, the NSA, you're not going to talk about this, but I'm going to keep asking you questions.
That's fine, because I don't know.
The NSA, they were monitoring satellite communications. Once the satellites took over communications for the space program, they didn't need that installation for NASA because they could do it through satellites.
That's correct.
But the NSA needed to hear what was going on the satellites, particularly during the Cold War, the Russian satellites. So they were monitoring what was going on with those satellites from this location, correct?
You'd have to tell me. You can go on the internet and you can take a look at what people say. Don't know. We weren't there. This site was closed in a base realignment in 1995, and we acquired it in 1998. And so since 1998, we've been there. But nobody from that time has sat me down and briefed me and said, here's what happened or here's what's going on. So I'm just like you.
So what they were doing at the – because we're fascinated with the NSA now because they're still spying, but now they're spying on us. It's still classified what they were doing. They have not declassified.
There are some things that are starting to become declassified, and that's why I say we occasionally will have somebody send us something they've read.
So the people don't just think that this is a little building someplace in the bowl at the top of a mountain. This is not. This is a big place, and at one time, 350 people were working there.
That's correct, 24 hours a day.
It's pretty fascinating that we can't talk about and don't know anything really about what was going on when 350 people worked there. And the Charlotte Observer tried to do an article on this years ago, and NBC News sent a reporter, and he flew around the site and took photographs of it, and we still don't know what was going on. How did they keep it secret?
Well, come on Saturday when we have our open house on to do the dedication, which is 9 to 5, and it's open to the public, free to the public.
I know that there are some trash cans still there that say non-secret material only, or declassified material only for the trash cans and things like that. Have you, in the course of refurbishing this, I'm sure it was stripped of everything that was secret, but did you find anything that might be they left behind, you know?
Well, it's
scraps of paper.
How interesting. I just uncovered a binder of the security that the one of the organizations that they'd hired. I had to go through the steps and procedures. So, yeah, there are some things that are there. There's signs and there's, you know, different things. But it was stripped, and it was – the good news is they left a beautiful 200-acre, 30-building underground tunnels, two large radio antennas, the 26-meter antennas, which are our signature instruments, and then the one 12-meter instrument, which Ken, one of our finest volunteers, is helping us to refurbish and get that up to speed. And we've got some, and we've got Smiley, which is a 4.6-meter telescope that has a smiley face pointed on it. And the reason it has a smiley face is because at one point during the DOD days, there was word that the Russians were taking pictures, and so they painted a smiley face on the antenna face, and so it stayed on there. And now kids love to see the smiley face on a 4.6-meter.
Talk to me, Ken, about this telescope. This is not just a telescope with a lens on it. This is a radio telescope, right?
Yes, it's a radio telescope. During the DOD days, we assume it was involved in intercept satellite communications. And it was interesting when I got involved in this way back in 2002. I was involved because some of the controls were obsolete and some I'd worked in industry. When I tried to run down some of the programming and for the controller, we finally found them on 7 1/4 floppies.
Oh.
And we managed to find a driver that would do this, but we couldn't get into it, and we had to go around the back door several ways to get it loaded into the program, and then we could do our computers.
So this is so people can understand this. This is not a telescope that you put your eye to and you point it up in the skies and it has a big thing at an opening at the top with a lens in it. This is a radio telescope that requires computers to both bring in the information and to make sense of the information.
Yes, it's a 40-foot diameter. We call it a 12-meter dish now. It's a 40-foot diameter, receives radio signals. Mm-hmm. And what we have done is upgraded the new control so we can use it for astronomical use rather than satellite intercepts. And we're in the process of doing that now.
So, well, a good example in terms of astronomical uses, we've taken the two 26 meter, which are 80 feet across. They're like these large antennas, like this movie Contact with Jodie Foster. It's mm-hmm. it's really dramatic, sitting in the middle of the National Forest. We've brought those together and used those now in what's called an interferometer, and we're using pulsars, which are millions of miles away, as background noise to collect information to look at things that are happening in stellar space. So it's a very interesting. And the good news about what we're doing now at Perry is that researchers are working side by side with students everywhere from K to 12 and college students and beyond, and everything's hands-on. So we have people that come and they're going to participate and hands-on and learn science by doing science.
Does that make this a unique facility in terms of the kind of work being done and by the people who are doing it?
It does, and yet it ties in with a lot of other things. For instance, we partner with Discovery Place just down the street from here, which is one of the finest science museums in the Southeast, and we work with their staff. We work with other staff. We're actually part of the North Carolina Grassroots Science Museum Collaborative, and we have displays. We have items that have flown in space. We've got a tire from the Discovery. We've got a wing section. This weekend we'll have astronauts. We're very excited because we're going to have a moon rock from Apollo 14 on display.
Wow.
On Saturday for the general public. So, and we've got meteorites. We've got pieces of Mars that are there on site. We've got meteorites that were seen to fall in 1492 and have been tracked ever since. So it's a wonderful place for people and young people to learn science, and not just young people. Everybody, our president, Don Klein, talks about K to Gray, and one of the opportunities there is for people like Ken who are volunteers who come, and we basically say, here's our science laboratory, Ken, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. And he steps in and steps up, and we take this whole thing to the whole next level. So it's a great opportunity and it's a unique opportunity in North Carolina.
You are a member of the Charlotte Astronomy Club, and you're working on this telescope, this radio telescope. What do you hope to do with it once it's fully operational to and up to snuff?
We want to get the instrument qualified to do a water maser survey, and water masers are hydrogen wavelengths associated with regions of new star formation. And there's never been a survey done in the northern hemisphere. There has been in the southern hemisphere.
Now, so, see, I thought astronomy club people were just guys who had telescopes at Freedom Park and looked up at the moon. you know stuff. This is science.
and it's fascinating. And the fascinating part of Perry, getting back to students, very few places I know of that students get to have their hands-on experience with equipment of this nature.
Because this is serious stuff. This is premium serious stuff.
Very, very much so.
The federal government put hundreds of millions of dollars into this facility when it was a NASA and, again, when it was an NSA facility. And some of that material, the telescopes, for instance, and the antenna and things like that, although they stripped of a lot of the electronics, which would have been obsolete today anyway, all that stuff is still there.
It's been refurbished. Yes. We've put millions of dollars into it. And not only that, the most exciting thing, I think, Mike, is that everything you've just described was unattainable by the general public. Right now, it's wide open. We have young people. We have class groups coming. We have summer programs. We have the Duke Talent Identification Program in astronomy that comes. We have homeschool programs. We've got people who come and they actually use the instruments. They're touching instruments that mm-hmm. cost millions and millions of dollars. They're collecting real science. And to see a young person actually get hands-on and learn science by doing science and their eyes light up really means a lot. That's what we're all about.
Do you vet their projects? In other words, do you say, okay, this is what you want to do. Okay, you can do it. Do they have to pitch something to you to do this, or they just show up?
We actually have several different ways to do it, several programs. My science director, Dr. Michael Castellez, will talk to him and work with him. My education director works with students. We do everything from senior projects in high school. We've worked with the UNC Charlotte engineering students who helped come build a telescope moving system for us for a Polaris telescope. So we work with all kinds of universities, all kinds of students, a lot of middle schools, and we try to develop programs. We've got a program that was just funded by Burroughs Welcome Fund that's going to be expanded statewide, and we're going to be looking at teaching girls 3D printing of planets, and we're going to use that to help for visually impaired people to understand what the planet, what the moon looks like, and what the other planets look like.
So, how do individuals and teachers and educational facilities reach you and talk to you about things that they would like to do?
Best thing is our website, pari.edu, www.pari.edu, Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute, edu. We put everything on there. We put it up. We have programs all the time. We're adding programs. This week's a big week with we have our annual membership thing. And then, as I say, Saturday, 9 to 5, come on out. It's open to the public. You'll see Moon Rock. You'll see lots of things.
PARI.org. That's Dr. David Clavier.
Dot edu.
PARI.edu.
Yes, sir.
David Clavier is Vice President of Administration and Development for the Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute. Ken Steiner, refurbishing radio telescopes. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Charlotte.